Hello and welcome to Distillations, weekly extracts from the past, present, and future of chemistry. I'm Robert Hicks. Each week we bring you stories on all things chemical, from fungus to formaldehyde. In this week's show, we're talking about preservation. We'll learn about a special technique for preserving rare manuscripts and find out whether it's really possible to deep freeze and then reanimate the human body. That's all coming up on today's episode of Distillations. Everything in the universe tends toward disorder. That's according to the second law of thermodynamics, which says that entropy, a measurement of the number of ways that atoms can be arranged, is constantly increasing, moving us ever so slowly towards randomness and destruction. That may sound dramatic, but what it comes down to is that it takes work to keep things the way they are. On today's show, we're examining ways to stave off the inevitable process of decay. For biological systems, this means a constant input of energy in the form of food, water, and sunlight. Audra Wolf has more in today's Element of the Week.
For archivists and manuscript librarians, preservation requires constant vigilance. Document maintenance is particularly challenging for the hugely popular manuscripts like the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution that must be displayed away from the safety of an archive. Preservationists have spent years coming up with ways to protect these precious documents. One solution, they found, is to surround the materials with a totally inert substance. And this is where argon, number 18 on the periodic table, comes in. Argon is a colorless, odorless member of the noble gas family and was the first of the noble gases to be discovered. Argon makes up almost 1% of the Earth's atmosphere, making it the most abundant of all the noble gases. But because it's significantly cheaper than the others, it's frequently used when oxygen needs to be replaced by something less reactive. Last December, in what is perhaps the world's most ambitious attempt to use argon in manuscript preservation, the Library of Congress displayed the only known remaining copy of Martin Waldseemüller's 1507 map that first gave the name America to the continents in the Western Hemisphere. The map is hermetically sealed in a 40-square-foot argon-filled case made of solid aluminum and non-reflective glass. The case was designed by specialists at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Assuming their calculations are correct, the device should keep out oxygen for at least 20 years. The map safety cushion of inert argon makes both the paper itself and the ink on the page safe to display in light, publicly preserving it for the millions of visitors who come to the Library of Congress each year. And that's it for the Element of the Week. I'm Audra Wolf.
Body Worlds, a traveling exhibition of human bodies and body parts preserved through the technique of plastination, has been one of the most popular museum shows in recent years. Although plastination produces uncannily lifelike results, it's only one of a host of techniques that makes the insides of dead bodies visible. To find out more, we spoke with Ron Wade of the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Ron, welcome to Distillations.
Good afternoon.
You are the director of the Maryland State Anatomy Board. What does that mean?
I have a responsibility for running the statewide body donation program that supports all of the medical institutions for medical education, basic science, as well as for surgical training, paramedic training, anything that deals in anatomical sciences where they need to work with cadaveric material, they would come to the anatomy board. We are the resource for the state.
How have the techniques to preserve bodies changed over time?
Actually, the preservation of bodies as we know it, you know, if we're used to going into the funeral home and where there's been a deceased prepared and there's a viewing and visitation, those original methods of preservation actually came about as a result of the development of Western medicine, where they developed things like alcohols and aldehydes and solutions that they would use to teach medical schools. At that time, they used very strong and astringent fluids, primarily had a lot of formaldehyde in it, for example. Back at the turn of the century, they used things like potassium nitrate, even arsenic. And since that, those kinds of chemicals have been removed because arsenic, for example, could be used to cover up a crime. So they eliminated arsenic from the fluids.
Now, you are an expert in plastination. What is it, and how does a body become plastinated?
Just like the Egyptian mummies, you know, that we look at mummies in the museums, they're preserved by virtue of desiccation, getting the water out. The process of plastination is much like what was used for years and years and years when you were preparing tissue for histology, looking under a microscope at tissue. What you did is you had the tissue, you stabilized the tissue, you stopped it from decaying and breaking down, autolysing, and then you would block the tissue, you would fix the tissue, and then you would mount it on slides. And this is the same, similar kind of process, only there's nothing getting mounted on slides. It's not very thin, it's rather large. It's as large as the anatomy is.
Understand you have prepared a mummy. Tell us about it.
What we tried to do in 1994 was to replicate the actual process that was used by the Egyptians, and it was the first time in probably about 2,800 years that an Egyptian type of mummification was done. The body that was selected was an elderly man who had been a donor for many, many, many years. He died of a long-term heart disease, cardiac problems, and basically at that point we treated him like a king, like a pharaoh. We tried in every way possible to duplicate what was the best embalming that was done by the Egyptians, the preservation methods, which was between the 18th and 21st dynasty, which would have included Ramesses the Great and Little King Tut. And it was an experiment. It wasn't just make a mummy, but we were actually seeing if we could duplicate what they did back then, 3,000 years before. And it's an ongoing project. He's still here, and we still do tissue cultures on him. We still do screening for bacteria and things like that.
And I trust you have some canopic jars to put the vital organs in.
Well, there's canopic jars with the mummy, and I do have a sarcophagus in my office, actually.
Ron, this has been an extremely informative interview. Thank you very much for appearing on Distillations.
You're quite welcome. I enjoyed it.
Ron Wade is director of the Anatomical Services Division of the University of Maryland School of Medicine and director of the Maryland State Anatomy Board. Have comments or questions about something you've heard on our show? Send your thoughts to distillations@chemheritage.org. You're listening to Distillations. I'm Robert Hicks. When you hear the words cryogenics or cryonics, you probably flash back to some sci-fi movie from the 1990s where the hero is frozen and sent into deep space, or put into cold storage to be thawed out in a strange and unfamiliar future. Producer Eric Mack wanted to find out what's going on in the world of extremely cold science, so he went to the area around Boulder, Colorado, where it's highly celebrated in more ways than one.
In the tiny mountain town of Nederland, Colorado, freezing cold temperatures are just another reason for a party. The town has been putting on a spring festival called Frozen Dead Guy Days since 2001. The festivities are in honor of the area's most famous resident, Bredo Morstel, a Norwegian man who has spent most of the last two decades frozen in a shed on his family's property. Grandpa Bredo, as he's known, was discovered after his grandson, a cryonics enthusiast, was deported back to Norway, and a media blitz ensued. Today, years later, Frozen Dead Guy Days brings thousands of people to this quaint little town for quirky events like the cryonics parade and the annual coffin races.
So what's the theme here? You're all dressed in scrubs?
Doctors.
Doctors.
We're bringing them back. No need to freeze.
Gotcha. What's your team name?
RMC Defibrillators.
The Defibrillators didn't crack the top three in the coffin races, but there were no signs of despair as they switched gears to get ready for the Saturday night pub crawl and one last chance to drink a toast to Grandpa. But not everyone who comes to Frozen Dead Guy Days is here for the fun and games. For Kenita Watson, founder of Go Cryo, a cryonics advocacy group, it's one of the few events where she can promote the science she's passionate about. She's set up a table in the Netherlands Best Western, where she's handing out surveys and making predictions on Grandpa Bredo's future.
He was packed on dry ice and brought back here after he had been dead for a while. So that's not the ideal way to even start cryonic suspension.
So I asked Watson how Grandpa should have been handled from the beginning.
The blood is washed out with basically a high-tech antifreeze. The cryoprotectant keeps your cells from freezing so that when you get colder and colder, it would be like molten glass hardening. And when you are warmed up, then the cryoprotectant would be removed, blood would be put back in, and they would proceed to cure whatever it was that got you in the first place.
It would be like making a cow out of hamburger. Every cell has been destroyed, and so how could you do that even in the future, bringing all those individual cells back to life?
That's Ray Radabaugh, who heads up the cryogenics program at the National Institute of Standards and Technology just down the road in Boulder. He says that so far, experiments with cryoprotectant haven't been very successful.
The problem comes in being able to freeze a tissue without the ice crystals forming that break the individual cell walls.
Radabas says he does know of plenty of medical uses for cryogenics, but instead of freezing cells to be thawed later, cryosurgery techniques are often used for cancer, uterine, and heart operations to freeze and destroy unwanted or malfunctioning cells. He says there's also a number of other applications for cryogenics that have nothing to do with biology or freezing cells, things like rocket propulsion and transporting fuels, and superconductivity, which is in high demand these days with rising energy costs.
Certain materials, if they're a low enough temperature, lose all resistance to the flow of electricity. You can make use of that in many different ways with transmission lines, transformers, motors, generators, and so on. If they're made of superconducting wire, they don't have the loss associated with them that regular copper wire does.
Cryonics doesn't make Radabas' list of uses for cryogenics, but when your old car tires reach the end of their lifespan, he says they're likely to be cryogenically frozen to make them easier to grind up. Not quite the same as reanimation, but it's a start. For Distillations, I'm Eric Mack.
Eric Mack is a producer based in northern New Mexico. And that's it for this week's episode of Distillations. Today's quotation comes from Neil Rawlinson, a British poet, from his poem, Entropy. I watch an ice cube melt in my wine, the heat of the Chardonnay passing into the ice. It means the universe is dying, the second law of thermodynamics, entropy rising. Distillations is a presentation of the Chemical Heritage Foundation and is made possible by the generous support of the Richard Lounsbery Foundation. Mia Lobel is our senior producer, with help this week from Lissa Rome. Our assistant producer is Victoria Indeviro, and our executive producer is Audra Wolf. Our theme music is composed and performed by Dave Kaufman. Additional music provided from the PodSafe Music Network. Check it out at music.podshow.com. Please tell us what you think about our program and send suggestions for future shows to distillations@chemheritage.org. Until next time, I'm Robert Hicks.